Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, December 13th, 2014. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host. On December 9th, the Senate Intelligence Committee released a long-delayed report on the U.S. use of torture against terrorism suspects during the Bush presidency. The report shows that the practices were systematic, brutal, and a violation of international law. This report was delayed for many, many months by the Obama administration. And while President Obama claims that he ended these practices, he's vigorously defended the CIA, especially his current CIA director, John Brennan, and is engaged in his own illegal actions, from drone warfare to the continued practice of regime change policies. Our first guest on today's program is Francis Boyle, who's not at all surprised by what has been released in the torture report. He argued persuasively for the impeachment of President George W. Bush, but was rebuffed by then-Speaker Nancy Pelosi, who took impeachment off the table. He's also offered to draft a bill of impeachment against President Obama for his multiple serious violations of international law and the U.S. Constitution. Only this time, it's the Republican Speaker, John Boehner, who took impeachment off the table. Professor Boyle is now very much focused on the policy of regime change carried out through brutal attacks on sovereign states with murderous results in Iraq, in Libya, in Syria, and now in Ukraine, which has put us on a path of war with Russia, which could become a war of thermonuclear extinction. Francis Boyle is a professor of international law at the University of Illinois in Champaign College of Law, and he is a renowned human rights activist. So, Francis, welcome to the program.
Well, Harley, thank you very much for having me on, and my best to your listening audience.
Well, I'd like to get right into your most crucial concern, which we spoke about briefly before, that we're already engaged in a proxy war with Russia over Ukraine. What can be done to prevent this from becoming a full-scale war, in your opinion?
Right. Well, I think it's a misnomer to call this a new Cold War. We're already in a hot war here in Ukraine with proxies, and it's right on the borders of Russia. It's extremely dangerous. In my lifetime, I cannot recall a situation so existentially dangerous since the Cuban Missile Crisis. And if this thing is not brought under control very quickly, it could escalate. I think the heart of it here, in my opinion, is Europe. It seems that the European states are, to some extent, understanding the problem and stepping back. Not that I'm a great supporter of French President Hollande, but he did stop by for this impromptu meeting with Putin. And then you also have this very important statement by the German leaders,
right,
asking for sanity here. I think this is very important because, unfortunately, Merkel seems to be going forward as Obama's cat's paw here in this policy. So,
well, you know, we saw something that you commented to me on of concern, which was this resolution in the House of Representatives, which seems to be placing all the blame on Russia's President Putin.
It's really a piece of neoconservative propaganda, the House resolution. The worst part is, though, giving President Obama authorization to provide military weapons, equipment, and supplies to this neo-Nazi government in Kiev. That's the real danger there. Now, when we know that Poroshenko came to Washington, he asked for weapons publicly. Obama publicly said no, but then sent over 200 U.S. special forces, in my opinion, to prepare the way for U.S. military intervention. And we know it's now been reported Poroshenko has been given substantial amounts of military equipment by U.S. NATO allies. So it could get far worse and more dangerous. I also regret to say, I mean, I guess you can read the U.S. news media for yourself, but I haven't seen so much anti-Russian propaganda since the height of the Cold War before Reagan and Gorbachev decided to end it. It's overwhelming. It's just terrible to sure see all the warmongering and everything else against Russia and President Putin. It's so bad that even Henry Kissinger criticized it, and that that means it's really bad. I went through the same PhD program at Harvard in political science that produced both Kissinger and Brzezinski before me. And they even gave me Kissinger's old office at Harvard Center for International Affairs. So I've been following the career of these two individuals for quite some time. I think, regretfully, what we see here is the Brzezinski policy in operation. We know that when Obama was a student at Columbia University, Brzezinski was his mentor. And then we also know that during his 2008 presidential campaign, Brzezinski ran his entire foreign affairs and defense operation. And then we know that after Obama was elected, Brzezinski put his key people in the State Department and the White House, wherever he could. And we know now for a fact Obama's top expert on Russia is a Brzezinski protege for the Center for Security and International Studies, where Brzezinski currently operates. He's on their board and is a trustee. So I think if we're looking for who's pulling the strings here and controlling the policy, it's Brzezinski, and that's extremely dangerous. We saw what he did in the Carter administration, arming, equipping, and supplying the Mujahideen that later came back, blowback under Al-Qaeda, the same people, to produce the, as he saw it, the collapse of the Soviet Union.
Well, and here Francis,
completely unrepentant about it. And now I'm afraid, Harley, he's doing the exact same thing in Ukraine, that the objective here, you know, is not just regime change, which is part of it, but Brzezinski made it clear in his book, The Grand Chessboard, he'd like to see the complete disintegration and dissolution of the Russian Federation itself. And I notice President Putin in his annual address there said, yes, certain sectors in the West want to see us dissolve like Yugoslavia. And I think that's exactly what Brzezinski and the Obama policies are about here. And what really struck me about President Putin's address is his invocation of the Great Patriotic War, which, you know, I've been over on lecture tours in the Soviet Union twice as their guest. I toured the front lines at Leningrad, Moscow, and I've been to Stalingrad as well. And I see the suffering and the courage and the integrity and the fortitude of the Russian people during the Great Patriotic War. But it's pretty ominous that President Putin feels he has to invoke the Great Patriotic War here to resist what Obama is doing. It's a very ominous statement. I don't think he's wrong, but it's quite an ominous statement. Plus, then you have all these aerial maneuvers and threats, starting by NATO and military maneuvers right on the border.
Well, Francis, let me go back to something that you did. Let me go back to something you mentioned earlier, because this is quite significant. You mentioned Putin's invocation of the Patriotic War. We also had in the statement from the 60 Germans, which included intellectuals, former Chancellor Schroeder, political figures, cultural figures, they actually referred to the present barrage against Russia as reminiscent of what Hitler did. And as you know, in Germany, for Germans to speak of Hitler as a precedent for the current policy, that's quite striking. So I think you're right about people in Europe seeing this as a war danger. But I'd like to come back to this question.
Well, I agree with you on that, Hartley. You know, I spent time in Germany, and, you know, I think most German people learn the lessons of World War II, but unfortunately it appears Merkel is doing the dirty work of Obama here as Obama's cat's paw, and I think it's really up to the German people and the good people in Germany, who I know are there, and that statement shows it, to rein her in. Because if we can break off Europe from Obama, I think there can then perhaps be a negotiated solution here and a de-escalation. But if you read that House resolution, that could only lead to war, outright war. There's no question about that. The implication, the implementation of that resolution, and then the very staunch position that President Putin made in his speech, the invocation of the Great Patriotic War and the dissolution of Yugoslavia. This is very dangerous on both sides, yes.
Well, Lyndon LaRouche has said that we've got to remove Obama through impeachment, and you have been very outspoken on this. What would you recommend if because obviously if the Europeans would do this, that would be fine, but we've got to change it in the United States. How would you foresee a move toward impeachment, and on what grounds would you think would be the strongest grounds that should be brought forward?
Right. Well, Harley, we've discussed this before. I think all we need, despite what House Speaker Boehner said, and, you know, he's just looking at it in terms of political calculations with respect to 2016, that the Republicans, I guess, get control of the White House. That's what he wants. I don't know if we're going to make it through 2016 if this
right.
Ukraine crisis is not brought under control. What we really need is just one member of the U.S. House of Representatives to introduce a bill of impeachment against President Obama, and that, I think, will get the ball rolling. As you know, there's enormous opposition to everything Obama is doing in the Democratic Party and of course, among Republicans. So, you know, we need one courageous member of the House to introduce a bill of impeachment. I know during the run-up to Go 4-1, the late, great Henry B. Gonzalez of Texas introduced his bill of impeachment against Bush Sr., and I was honored and privileged to do the first draft of that and serve as counsel to him, along with my friend Ramsey Clark. And that did have a role to play, because Bush Sr. said in his memoirs that the reason he did not march all the way to Baghdad from Basra, was his fear of impeachment. So we need someone like Henry B. Gonzalez with the guts to put that bill in, and then I think mobilize behind that bill. Now, the current session of Congress is going out of business, so I think it should be the top priority between now and the new session of Congress to get that member of Congress, whether Democrat or Republican, and put the bill in and start the ball rolling.
You know, when I speak to people who say, well, we don't have the votes, there aren't enough Republicans, it's not enough to convict in the Senate, what I've always said is, make the case. If the American people see the case against the president, the numerous violations and what effect it's having on them, and now with this danger of nuclear war, I think the case can be made to stick. Now, I'd like to ask
you... Well, I agree with you, Hartley. I think we need a bill of impeachment in there, and then to make the case with Congressman Gonzalez. He had a press conference at the National Press club. I couldn't make it out there, but I had one out here, and that did go out nationwide and state the case for why President Obama should be removed from office to stop certainly what's going on in Ukraine now. And I think even putting in a bill of impeachment would send a shot across his bow, which he definitely needs. You see, you had mentioned the torture report. Well, you know, yesterday he was defending the
Brandon,
director of the CIA and what the CIA had did, and saying he had full confidence in him. Well, look, Obama was after me at Harvard Law School. He knows what the law is here, and that he has an obligation to prosecute for torture and war crimes. He knows better, unlike Bush Jr., who, you know, was not a lawyer. So, okay, but Obama is. He's a graduate of Harvard Law School. He took an oath to uphold the Constitution and laws when he was sworn into the Illinois bar years ago. So, you know, he knows what should be done, and he's refusing to do it.
Now, Francis, do you think if you were involved in drafting a bill of impeachment, obviously you think there are more than enough counts to make the case?
Well, yes, I would go. I mean, obviously, it would depend on the member himself or herself. Congressman Gonzalez basically delegated to me to come up with a bill of particulars, which I did do, based on violations of international law and U.S. constitutional law related to the upcoming war against Iraq. But certainly with respect to President Obama, we have, to start with, his clearly unconstitutional war against Libya that exterminated about 50,000 Libyans and destroyed Libya as a state. Second, we have the National Defense Authorization Act that he signed into law, basically allowing the military to pick up anyone here in the United States in violation of the Constitution and incarcerate us, and who knows what else to do with us. Third, you have the Obama drone strike campaign,
right,
and in particular, his murdering now five United States citizens, and his defense of murdering United States citizens in violation of the Bill of Rights, and now the current count is five under U.S. citizens, and now he is waging war in Iraq and in Syria. Again, in violation of the War Powers Clause of the Constitution and the War Powers Resolution, no authorization from anyone. Mm-hmm. So that's, you know, that's just to begin. If you know, a member of Congress wants to discuss other matters here, I could review it, and you know, if I agree in good faith, I could certainly draft those articles of impeachment. But this is just the start.
Well, Francis, I think what we're also seeing now for the first time is Democrats moving in opposition to the president. The courage of Feinstein to bring forward the Senator Feinstein to bring forward the torture report, in spite of threats from the CIA and also opposition from Obama. There's a big fight developing over the policy that Obama's supporting for bailing out the derivatives markets. This was a huge fight yesterday. So
right.
We may actually be at a point where there can be bipartisan opposition.
Right. Senator Warren just rebelled over that. Right. I just saw her speaking on the news last night. So and now you have Democratic candidates for the presidency breaking with Obama. So, yes, I think you're right, Harley, politically, that there very well could be some Democratic support for this initiative. Yes.
Well, Professor Boyle, thank you very much for taking some time to join us. And we may be back with you in the beginning of the year, because maybe with the new Congress, we actually will have need for your services to draft a bill of impeachment.
Well, Harley, let me say this. Congress is breaking now. This Congress will end. And everyone's coming home for the holidays. And so what needs to be done is in your listening audience, everyone needs to personally buttonhole their member of the House when he or she comes home and demand a bill of impeachment be put in against Obama immediately upon convening the new Congress. We need to do that right away, and it was the third week in January they come back. So they're all going to be home. You can go over to their offices. My advice is, you know, don't just send them letters or emails, phone calls. Get an appointment, go in, and say, I want you to put that bill of impeachment in against President Obama first thing when you get back to Washington, D.C. And, you know, if you want, you can give Professor Boyle a call. He's willing to work with you, serve as your counsel, free of charge on this matter. Because, you know, we simply have to stop the existentially dangerous direction this country is moving across the board. The Middle East, China, where Obama's pivot toward Asia is really a pivot against China, and now against Russia in Ukraine, that could get far worse if that House resolution is just horrendous. And, you know, Brzezinski is calling the shots here, and we know what his ultimate objective is, and we know what President Putin's position is on it. And if we can't stop them, I'm afraid we could be seeing a war here.
Well, thank you again very much. I think people should take your advice. This is what we've been telling them to do, but we're always glad to hear someone else joining in on this. So we'll be back with you sometime in the new year.
All right.
Thanks
a lot, Harley. Bye-bye.
Yeah. And now we're going to be joined by LaRouche National Policy Committee member Michael Steger to follow up on what Professor Boyle said and also to take up the question that Lyndon LaRouche has raised, which is that Obama's attempt to suppress the torture report and his continued classification of the 28 pages identifying the Saudi role in 9/11 is designed to protect the candidacy of another one of the fascist family Bush, namely Jeb Bush. So, Michael, are you there?
Yeah, hi, Harley. Can you hear me?
Sure. Welcome to the program. You just heard Professor Boyle. I think his proposal was very well formulated, that we've got to get a mobilization now because there is a break beginning in the Democratic Party, and we've got to exploit that using the courage of Feinstein in bringing forward the torture report. I wonder if you'd like to add something to what he said on that.
Sure. Well, I think we see a compounding of events here in just the recent period. So obviously the election was a denunciation of the Obama administration. You had, you know, very moderate Democrats who in some cases may have done a lot for their states as senators or congressmen. And the reality was that they were beaten by very inexperienced or very freshman, very extreme right wing in some cases, senators, simply because of the Obama name. That was the condemnation of many people running for office. Now, that came very clear to the American people. This was a condemnation of Obama. Following that, you see now this report released by Feinstein, which was clearly a fairly courageous act. There was a lot of pressure put on her from Obama, from Brennan. This was this is the report that was written by Senate Intelligence Committee staff who were then threatened. Their computers were confiscated, and they were threatened with federal prosecution for spying on the CIA. So obviously not something that was uncontested by the Obama administration. Absolutely was moved against, and Obama personally tried to suppress this. So in that context, she came out basically a minute before midnight that if the Republicans had taken over the Senate Intelligence Committee, that report would have never seen the light of day. And so a few days before that happened, Feinstein took the report and made it public. And it's now exposed the gross hypocrisy and fascist nature of this post-9/11 period under both Bush Jr. and Obama. And that is now having shockwave effect on an international scale and is really changing the dialogue and even the emotional condition of the American people who are having to confront what they themselves have accepted these last 15 years. And then now just yesterday, there was a major fight over this funding bill for the federal government. And what again you saw was a revolt from both now Democrats, leading Democrats, people like Maxine Waters, who has been completely silent, both on the Financial Services Committee and as well on Obama for years, has done nothing really publicly about gross hypocrisy from this administration's support for Wall Street, was out yesterday saying, don't be intimidated by the president, don't listen to the president, vote your conscience, oppose this bill, because this bill was deregulating the what was a legitimate attempt to restrict, or at least I don't know if it was legitimate, but it was an attempt to restrict Wall Street's gambling with the American people's money.
It was a minimal attempt, but it was an important one, because the whole idea behind Dodd-Frank was that this was going to end the practices of 2008 that led to the crash. Of course, it did nothing of the sort, and much of the legislation was written by the very hedge fund dealers and swap dealers that were supposedly being regulated. But on this one issue, where they're now trying to extend government protection to losses in commodity derivatives, you know, this is really quite an extreme position. And it was Elizabeth Warren and Maxine Waters and others who went out and fought this. Now, I don't know exactly. I heard that the budget bill did pass last night, so I don't know if the House rammed it through above the objections of the Democrats. Do you know, Michael? Did you hear anything on that?
They were able to sway two Tea Party votes over to the Republican, the Bush League Republicans. And that's basically what this was. It was Bush League Republicans and Obama directly in bed together with the Wall Street fascists pushing this whole bill through. And they got two Tea Party Republicans to switch their votes. The bill passed by two votes in the House. It's now in the Senate, and it's not clear what's going to happen today, though it's probably likely to pass. The bigger point, though, is the political shift you see now in the United States, where there is a rejection of this Bush League, Obama, dictatorship policy directly coinciding with the Wall Street program. And that means there's a political opening for the LaRouche program and the LaRouche policy to join with the BRICS, to go with Glass-Steagall. And I think that really is the leading issue for the American people today.
Now, in the discussion that the policy committee had with Mr. LaRouche a couple of days ago, he reiterated very forcefully this important point that what we're seeing is the ground being prepared for a Jeb Bush presidency. And, you know, the mythology about Jeb Bush is that, well, he's smarter than W. Well, you know, I've seen pumpkins smarter than W. That's hardly a qualification. But that he's more moderate, more reasonable. The fact is that Jeb Bush was one of the initiators of the PNAC, the Project for a New American Century, which included Wolfowitz and Rumsfeld and Cheney and the most extreme neocons who pushed for war, pushed for the Iraq War. Why don't you just give a little bit of a report on Mr. LaRouche's comments, because I think this is extremely important that we take this opportunity now of the torture report coming out to finish off the Bush dynasty and to, by doing so, create the openings in the Democratic Party for a real debate.
Yep. So a couple of things I think stand out in this case. One is that the Bush family goes back directly to the leading financiers funding Hitler. So this is a Nazi pedigree directly involved in really what was an existential threat to civilization from the Nazis, from Hitler, backed by London, backed by Wall Street, including Prescott Bush. And the key target of these institutions was to send Hitler to destroy Russia. Now, Hitler's generals thought otherwise. They knew that that would be a destruction of Germany. So they moved first to France and to the West. But that was the point, to destroy Russia. That's exactly what the Bush administration and the Jeb Bush administration would be an all-out push for world war. And I think that what's very obvious is that another founding author of the Project for New American Century, otherwise known as PNAC, along with Jeb Bush, was Robert Kagan. Robert Kagan's wife is Victoria Nuland, the leading provocateur orchestrating the Nazi coup in Kiev. And I think what Francis said, which was, I think, very important, was that we are already looking at a hot proxy war between the U.S. and Russia in Ukraine. You've got fascists backed by the United States, by Victoria Nuland, by Obama, by the Bush family, pushing on Russia's border for a conflict with Russia. And that is exactly why this Jeb Bush presidency has to be shut down, and it has to be shut down now before it starts.
Now, the other side of this is that in the Republican Party, you see interesting kinds of fracturing. You had 5 Republicans vote against this war resolution. They tend to be the same Republicans who are calling for the exposure of the 28 pages, people like Walter Jones, Massey of Kentucky, I think Yoho of Florida. But it, also you see someone like Ron Paul, who has come out very forcefully against the direction of war in Ukraine and in the Middle East, the demand that there be some congressional action on this. And on the Democratic side, we've just reviewed some of the areas where there's a split. I think we should also note that even a guy who's been generally friendly to Wall Street, like Chuck Schumer, the senator from New York, and Tom Harkin, who's been decidedly an opponent of Wall Street, both acknowledged that it was a mistake to go with Obamacare in 2009. So we are seeing a changed political climate. Now, this brings us to the real question, Michael, and I know you do a lot of organizing. You have a real sense of what people are thinking out in the Bay Area. To what extent is this changed environment starting to get through to the man on the street?
Well, I think that it depends on the quality of competence and thinking of the man on the street. I mean, it very much varies. What we're finding, I think, across the country, we obviously have, as part of LaRouche PAC, and under Mr. LaRouche's direction, launched what's called the Manhattan Project, which is a major intervention into Manhattan, which is taking place now over the course of months. But what we're seeing both in New York City, in the Bay Area, and I think across the country, from a number of these what are immigrant groups, Chinese Americans, Indian Americans, Ibero Americans, people from South America or from Mexico. What we have, we've had a number of conferences related to the Schiller Institute. I think you guys had one in Houston yesterday. We're having people from the Brazil consulate, from the Egyptian consulate. You're seeing a kind of an awakening from a certain demographic in the United States that was not political. But we're generally optimistic of the United States. They came here as immigrants because they sought a better future. They sought a better life for their children and grandchildren, educational institutions, the questions of science, the questions of technology, potential for advancement of their community, of their society. And we're seeing now a political awakening from that community. What we're finding from a lot of the other Americans who have maybe been here for generations is a kind of cynicism that you're not going to be able to change things. And I think that really is the root of the problem. And I think what's required is more and more of those, and obviously some people at the higher levels of institutional thinking. We are seeing a shift from some of the senators, as you mentioned. We need to see more of a shift from some of the professors, from some of the people in the university institutions. At this point, we have to break the blackout. You've got a suppression of a general sense of where the world is going inside the United States. That all people hear about all these various problems. They hear about the problems of Putin. They hear about the problems of China. And in reality, the United States is collapsing. Our economy is collapsing. We're fracking to try to stay alive. We're poisoning our own water and land to attempt to maintain some kind of, you know, appearance of economic development. So, I think we've got to break that silence. And if we do that, if we break the silence on the bricks and what the real potential for development is, I think we can awaken a kind of optimism in the average man on the street, which is absolutely critical to not only get rid of Obama, get rid of this fascist program, but to really kickstart an FDR John Kennedy development program.
Well, you just touched on one of the leading issues, which is that people are still to some extent influenced by the love of money in their thinking about economics. And what we're seeing in front of us unfolding, most Americans don't see it, but we see it because we're a part of it, is this BRICS process. And I think that's something we have to communicate to the American people, that in China, in India, in countries like Egypt and Bolivia. There's a commitment to the most advanced science and technological progress as the way to address economic problems, as opposed to creating, through financial innovation, a flood of money, which essentially gives you license to buy nothing. So I know also you have all the ethnic communities in the Bay Area where you're organizing. Are we getting some resonance on this whole question of what the BRICS are doing, the China, Russia, India initiatives for these new global development funds?
Yeah, I think there's a great awakening, and among some of these immigrant communities, the difference is that the context that it's happening in, the BRICS is not just an attempt to develop these other nations. It's not just an attempt to allow other nations to develop, though it definitely is. This is a potential for a transformation of the entire global human economic system. This really has the potential to unleash and transform what the human species becomes, to eliminate this geopolitical environment, to undermine or basically to override the attempt to define man as either an animal, as a beast, based on just carnal desires, or as an artificial intelligence, just simply an analytical processing system. But there's actually something much more beautiful, much more profound about the human society and about the human species. And what I think what typifies that and what you do see from some of these countries is a commitment to a space exploration program. You see it in China's lunar program. You see it in the collaboration of what's a burgeoning collaboration between China, Russia, and India on the potentials for lunar exploration. That really does typify where things can go. And I think this is kind of what we have to continue to communicate, because there really is a potential for this thing to break wide open. And the political changes we now see happening in the United States mean it is even more possible. Obama's administration has been condemned, essentially. All he has accomplished, except for war and destruction, on a legislative level, was Obamacare. And even that was an atrocious Nazi piece of legislation. Now you've got Democrats condemning that as worthless, as we never should have done it. So I think we've really got to take this window politically, historically, and move this country back in the tradition of the BRICS, which is Lincoln, it's Roosevelt, it's Kennedy. The BRICS nations have adopted that American legacy, and I think it's time that we adopt it ourselves.
Now, this legacy is something that has been written out of the education process. There are very few people in Congress who really know the difference between Lincoln and FDR versus the current thinking. So this is going to be a fight, but I think this question of being able to communicate the hypocrisy and the ironies, they're just so replete. I mean, the idea that we're saying that China's economy is going into a severe crisis because their growth rate has slowed to 8% per year, when in most of the transatlantic region we've got 0% growth or negative growth. I want to come back to the foreign policy question for a minute, though, because there are a number of things here. For example, in the torture report, the U.S. is still lecturing countries on human rights. And, I just like your thinking on that, because a lot of our organizers who go out to organize have trouble breaking through the narrow localism of the American population. And part of what Lyndon LaRouche is discussing with the so-called Manhattan Project is that we've got to broaden people's thinking so they think about the whole nation and the whole nation in the context of the international community. And Mrs. LaRouche has been very forceful in saying, look, the rest of the world looks at the United States as an evil country right now. So in your organizing, Michael, how do you bring people to realize that this is not the country they grew up in? This is especially for people who grew up, who were born before 1970. How do you communicate this to people?
Well, I think it's just a commitment to know that we have to be completely honest about what we've become, that we are living in a Nazi takeover of the United States. You could say that began with the assassination of John Kennedy. It was a cultural takeover, But since 9/11, there was a fascist coup, a Reichstag-like fire, that undermined the fundamental, not just fabric of constitutional law, but the actual question of how we viewed and understood the basic natural law of human society, that was undermined. And that we have to be willing to confront people with that. What we were finding in outreach initially to the American population on this torture report, that many Americans had this attempt to defend their oppressors, to identify with this Nazi coup, and say, we should never have released it, this has put Americans in danger, everything we did was right. And the reality is that that's typical of someone who's been enslaved for a little too long and has lost even the notion of what freedom looks like, mm-hmm. what freedom of thought, but most importantly, what freedom of development looks like. And that really, I think, brings us back to the Hamilton question, because Hamilton knew we were not going to develop as separate states or separate communities. We would develop to the extent we identified ourselves as a union, as a one nation, and we established then a way of operating that could look to say, what will the future be of that one nation? And how then? What steps do we need to take physically to ensure that future exists? So he set up the credit system. He set up the national banking system. He put an emphasis on manufacturing and science, and most importantly, he put an emphasis on the human mind. That's real economics. I mean, that's what the Chinese have essentially done. And I think what's ironic, you point out another irony. I attended a high-speed rail conference recently in Los Angeles, and you had this one, he was a vice president sales and management of a industrial company headquartered outside Pittsburgh, old brick and timber steel kind of company. And he was just jubilated that the Chinese were going to be building. Not only are they going to build one of the new T trains for the Boston Metro subway system, but they're going to build a 400,000 square foot factory in Springfield, Massachusetts, which is like many of these small towns in the United States, was formal manufacturing and is now a very depressed and desolated area. And they're going to bring back a manufacturing plant of light rail production inside the United States. And you kind of see what's taking place, that what the Chinese and what the Chinese president Xi Jinping is offering is a chance for real development. They're offering an extended hand to say, let's collaborate and develop this picture. And I think we've just got to be honest about both characteristics, but it's a quality of leadership. It's a quality of a sense of emotional honesty to confront the worst of the truth and also look at the greatest potential and hope that we have as a nation. And to the extent we do that, I think we can inspire the American people.
And I think one of the points that's critical here is that you have a propaganda machine that's still pumping out these stories that Putin is the criminal, that the Chinese are a dictatorship, and you know they're playing on the fears of Americans. And this comes up, this brings up the question of the torture report. Well, who are the Chinese torturing people? Are the Chinese droning people? Are they conducting regime change? And I think this is the dirty side of the present U.S. policy of the last two administrations that America has to confront. And that's why the Feinstein committee putting out this report is so important. And it can't just be glossed over. We can't let it just become an arguing point on Fox News. Well, does this put our American citizens in danger from terrorists? No, it's the policy of torture that puts us in danger. It's the drone policy that puts us in danger. And I think that's why, on the other side, the idea of cooperation from the BRICS is so important as a rejection of these geopolitical doctrines.
Yeah, maybe we should put a petition together that condemns the mass media of the United States as another form of torture. Because I think the American people are tortured on a daily basis. I mean, you do find that the people who do turn off their televisions and turn off their constant barragement of mass media and get a little bit of distance from the constant lies do begin to look around them and get a glimmer of reality in this country, which is that we are facing a complete economic collapse. One of the reasons they had to put on tag on this amendment regarding derivatives on this government funding bill is because this financial system is about to blow. That the Wall Street financial system is now 50% more indebted than it was in 2008 when the system blew because of its over-leveraged debt. And the fact is that they've also pinned a lot on this fracking business in South Dakota and elsewhere across the country, which is a complete boondoggle. The price of oil collapse, basically because of the Saudis' attempt to undermine Russia, has also threatened to blow out the derivatives and futures contracts on the fracking natural gas contracts. This itself can blow out Wall Street. And so these guys are desperate. Reportedly, Jamie Dimon was making calls yesterday to make sure that the Congress passed this amendment. And so this was an outright brawl from the top levels of Wall Street to impose on the American people that they are going to have to pay when this system blows again. And I think it's absolutely critical that we now take the steps to make sure that that stops. But I think people have to realize this is a form of torture. This culture is really a kind of torture. And I think a lot of people realize that. The problem is that they have to regain a sense of identity, that we're going to fight for something better, that our country was intended to be the most beautiful country that was ever created in the world. It was a new country. It's a new idea. And that really has a certain unique contribution to mankind, even today. But we've got to bring that back to full life.
Now, one of the other concerns that Mr. LaRouche always comes back to on the policy committee is the question of the desiccation of the Southwest, the lack of rain, the water diminishing, the what you live in the middle of it. Now, there's been a little bit of rain the last couple of days, in fact, a lot of rain, but this tends to get just washed right back into the ocean with landslides and things of that sort. What can you tell us about the current situation with the drought in California, and is there a discussion among legislators about what to do other than providing bottled water to cities that are dry?
There's no discussion at all among legislators. I think that the point to be made, the first point to be made, is that post-World War II, under the Franklin Roosevelt, John Kennedy era, including Eisenhower and what he did to help extend the nation's transportation system, was a major demographic shift to make areas like Texas and California habitable. One, as you know, without air conditioning, Texas is a tough place. But you needed water, you needed air conditioning, you needed electricity. You also brought in the most advanced areas of the scientific and space programs. You have JPL, you have NASA Houston. So critical areas of advancement for the country, which created massive population booms in this part of the country, especially in California, because it had both the scientific questions, the agricultural capabilities in the Central Valley from the water programs of Roosevelt, and as well as an advanced educational system. But people back then already saw that there would be an insufficient supply of water, fundamentally because it's so arid. We are in a total desert west of the Mississippi, west of the Missouri River, especially south, you know, south of Nevada and south of San Francisco, that that major steps would have to be taken to look at a long-term, consistent water supply. And that was done. In the 1950s, they already pulled together and assembled a design and a conception called NOAAPA that would have done that. And the failure, the tragedy, is that it was not done. That instead of developing those kinds of projects to fulfill the idea of a full continental nation, instead we launched into the Vietnam War, we launched into a cultural revolution, which included an attack on industry, an attack on science, an attack on nuclear power. And it undermined the potential for that size of a project, which went from Alaska all the way down to Mexico. So today we're in a much, much more precarious situation. We've now got up to 40 million people who may have to migrate over the course of the coming years. Because if the rainfall continues, now there's been reports recently, this is the worst drought in 1,200 years. And there have been droughts over these previous thousands of years, which have gone on for decades. So we could be in a situation which is is very challenging. Now, the only solution to get out of this is to go to a fundamental scientific advancement. That means we have to work with China, we have to work with Russia, we have to work with India. These nations provide, especially China, a kind of scientific shift that makes this possible. What we're getting right now in terms of rain is what they call the Pineapple Express.
Right.
And it's actually a funny kind of rain. It doesn't come down from Alaska and Seattle. It actually comes off of this equatorial rain water belt that hits the tropics. And it shoots off of that out of the Pacific and heads northeast and into the areas of Central California, like San Francisco and Santa Barbara and these areas. And this is really the, now the question, they call this an atmospheric river. Is it possible? And these are some of the questions that our organization is asking, as well as that there are other scientists that we're in contact with, some of which are in Russia, who are asking questions, how do we then control or provide a certain influence on these atmospheric rivers? Can we actually find a kind of scientific knowledge, a scientific platform that allows us to have more influence and control over water supply in the atmosphere? Because there is huge water potential constantly in our atmosphere. The question is, how do you harness it? How do you make it rain? Now, there's an interesting proposal. There is one idea of providing ionization systems up and down California, somewhere between 10 to 15 ionization systems throughout the state of California, which some are estimating to be, you know, merely $100 million to build. It's not very extensive, which they're saying can work. Now, there are things.
$100 million, Michael. That's one movie. They
yeah, right.
That to produce a movie.
That's right. They could produce. Hollywood could build it. So there are things that we could do. But I think the bigger question is the kind of fundamental scientific revolution that mankind requires. But along with the revolution in our financial system, and a complete shift out of this old imperial geopolitical relationship among nations, which is what the BRICS represents, a higher form of collaboration of peoples towards the common ends of mankind, is a real revolution in scientific thought. And Mr. LaRouche has been emphatic during his entire political career that that's fundamentally what drives human progress. I mean, Kepler's discovery of the planetary orbits created a fundamental shift in mankind's ability to have the confidence to take on the daunting challenges that mankind faced. In every area, from questions of time and navigation to energy, the steam engine, to basic scientific questions of light, all of this was provoked because of a willingness to take on a revolution in our understanding of the universe and our role within it.
And it's an inherently optimistic trend, because once you begin to realize that you can come to hypothesize and understand things that you can't see, that are beyond our immediate senses, you realize that everything is open to us, that there's nothing that theoretically is beyond our ability to make discoveries.
Right. And I think that's partly where this culture question comes in, because it is so suppressive. The media, the education, the music today, it really undermines a quality of mind that we have to reawaken in the American population. I mean, the Americans have lost an appreciation of great beauty. They, even if they interact with it, the poet and writer Friedrich Schiller makes this point. The American people have become callous to even the idea of beauty. Even when they experience it, they've lost a certain faculty to appreciate it. And I think as political organizers and as real American citizens, our responsibility is to reawaken that appreciation of real beauty, of what the human soul really means, because it does have real value. It has physical significance, as Socrates made pretty clear.
Well, and the idea that this is something that people demand from their government, for example, public education. Public education has gone to hell, and Obama's destroying it. He took Bush's No Child Left Behind and made it even worse. And so you have this loss of an idea of an ability to think creatively and scientifically. But the only way to get it back is going to be to fight to make the government responsive to the real needs of a population. Now, we just have a couple minutes left. I'd like to go back to the last comments from Francis Boyle, where he encouraged our listeners to mobilize to get an impeachment process underway. We've been fighting this for a while, and some of our supporters have gotten a little bit cynical about this. But I think that the developments that you and I have been discussing and that we discussed with Francis Boyle make it clear that we're at a break point. So what would you say to the people out there who are saying, well, I've tried, it's not going to work? What's at stake here? Why should they redouble their efforts now?
Well, it's much like the American Revolution, where we now have an opportunity to back the British Empire up against the wall. And their greatest weakness is Obama. He is collapsing. He is desperate. He is directly, publicly now in bed with the worst of the Republican establishment against his own party, against the own Democratic Party. So if he was ever more vulnerable for impeachment, it would be now. And I think what we've got to mobilize and take on the tenacity and courage to really go out there and say that if anyone, as you said earlier, if someone were to read a full indictment of this presidency on the House floor, be it Republican or Democrat, but were to read a full indictment of this presidency, he would psychologically crumble, and this administration would be washed out of Washington for good.
And it would be impossible for congressmen to ignore it, because the criminal activity is so clear, and the violation of the American Constitution is so clear. You couldn't ignore it.
And the hatred by the American people is so clear. I mean, no one can deny the American people came out on November 4th and condemned this president en masse.
So we're looking at a potential now for a real revolutionary upsurge. Michael, you have an event coming up, I believe, in San Francisco. Is that this weekend or is it next weekend?
It is tomorrow.
Okay, so people who are listening to this can still get over to the event. Why don't you give the information on it?
Yeah, it starts 1 o'clock Pacific time, Saturday, December 13th. It's at the Fort Mason Center, which is up on the north end of the city. It's Building C, room 205, and there's parking nearby. There's a parking lot there. So if you can make it over, please come by, and if not, you can look for more information. There'll be upcoming events beginning even this month in December, both in Los Angeles and Seattle, and then upcoming events in January and February that will be listed on the LaRouchePack.com website.
Well, so as soon as you're done listening to this program, get in your car, and it's 1 p.m. Pacific time, and give the address again, Michael.
It's Fort Mason Center, Building C, room 205.
Okay, well, I think between what we got from Francis Boyle and your development of this Bush flank and the Obama-Bush alliance, we're now in a position where our listeners can go out with confidence and say that we now have the opportunity to rid the country of this 15 years so far of absolute destruction. So, Michael, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Harley.
And we'll be back next Saturday, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for the next edition of The LaRouche Show. And I would encourage everyone to go to the LaRouchePack.com website to see the weekly Friday night webcasts, which feature a discussion with Mr. LaRouche or his associates on the leading issues of the day, as well as on Monday with the LaRouche Policy Committee discussion with Mr. LaRouche. So until next week, thanks for joining us.